Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, July 25th, 2000. In the fireside room this afternoon is Dale Jamkard with session number 2007. It is titled, Far More is Possible than you Imagine. Whoever finds one life will lose it, and whoever loses one's life will find it. Let's listen in.
On this beautiful day, it's both warm enough and cool enough for whatever. It's really rich. I'm Dale Jamkard. Got some seats up here. I have worked as a pastor and also as a psychotherapist and also as a director of life education for Lutheran Family Service. And I've been doing classes up here since 1972, every 3 or 4 years. So it's been a rich part of my life, and it's always a pleasure to come back and be with Holden people and Holden kinds of interests and questions. It's an exciting time for me, a rich part of my life. The theme this summer is Heirs of the Promise. And what do you think is the legacy? I mean, you're an heir, now you really better check what the legacy is. What are some ideas about what do you think of as the legacy of the promise?
God's promise to Abraham.
Okay. And can you say what that promise was?
That his family will be as many... Gets me on the boat on Saturday. As many as the stars in the heaven and the sands on the ground.
Okay, so you want that promise to be...
Yes, I do. This is a family of God right here. We're all children of God. You'll be a blessing.
Okay, that he was blessed to be a blessing.
Through you all nations
of the... Now, what other promises?
Salvation?
Mm-hmm. And what would that mean?
I think meeting Christ in the next life.
Meeting Christ in the next life.
Forevermore.
Okay.
Wholeness for this life.
Wholeness.
Mm-hmm. He will never leave us. He will never leave us.
God never leave us. Okay. Any others? Okay, well, one that I'm kind of following along with these others is that Jesus said, I came that you might have life and have it abundantly. So that salvation for me is not only an assurance of life with God from now to forever, but it is very much about life here and now. And one of the things that Jesus said is not only that he gives us life, but he talks about life abundant. And then he says things, way off kinds of stuff, like far more is possible than you think or you can imagine. And so I'm concerned whether we're settling for peanuts when he really wants to give us a feast. And I'm concerned because if we really participate in the feast, we would be so excited about what we were experiencing that our churches would be vibrant. So oftentimes our churches are not very vibrant. There's some seats up here if you want. Come on up. Okay. I saw a play or a ballet actually in St. Petersburg a couple of weeks ago, and it's Giselle. And anyway, the lead in the play has hurt his loved one. And he's very despondent, And then she finally forgives him. And he leaps around the stage just with glee. He's, wow, I'm forgiven. Well, I haven't seen anyone leap out of church.
Oh, come on.
So anyway, what I want to do is raise the question, if far more is possible, how do we get in the way of participating in that? Are we really settling for too little by the way we approach and participate in our Christian faith and in our church life? And are we cheating ourselves of how much God would really want to give us? To explore that, I have looked at how we understand faith and who we are, and how that developed lately in history, and then also how the shift from Newtonian physics to quantum physics, I think, is changing things. And then I'm reading a book now, or have read it, and it's one I recommended for people, by Larry Dossey. And you might have heard his name. He is a physician that has been doing a compilation of the research on the effectiveness of prayer. And one of the things he says, he expected to find two or three research projects. Instead, he's found 150. And he said, the evidence is overwhelming that prayer makes a difference. And as a result of some of the early studies now, the base is enough evidence. Harvard is running a study with 1,200 people being studied, and Duke is running a major study on the effectiveness of prayer. So there's some shifts taking place. Seats up here if you'd like. Major shifts, and I think that what happened is that Newtonian physics kind of said, if we can just figure out the smallest piece of what things are made of, then we will understand how everything works. And that's what reality is. And the mind, well, that's a product of the cells in the brain. And so we'll get that figured out. Spiritual, God, they often either just didn't comment or had some idea that that was somehow a projection out of our need for some kind of a religious orientation. Well, that whole approach is being called into question by quantum physics. There was no mystery in that approach, and quantum physics is now talking about mystery. And quantum physics, one major shift, and I spent most of the time yesterday on this, so I don't want to go over all of it again, but just to catch you up. A major shift is that Newtonian physics tended to think of reality and what we're made of as its. That there are basic little its of which we are combinations of. Quantum physics, in a very general way, thinks of things as happenings. And one little example of that, one of the particles is called a boson. And the definition I read of a boson was it was a burst of energy that lasts a millionth of a millionth of a millionth of a second. Now, if we are made up of happenings, like a fireworks display, notice how dynamic that is. Notice how difficult it was to think that faith could be the way in which we could be healed, be changed, could affect everything in our lives when we were in it. When we're a happening, a dynamic happening, faith has a whole different dimension to it. And also then, if these bursts of energy are what things are made of. We've got a couple seats up here, if you'd like.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Very inconspicuous.
The scientists that are willing to move really toward the mystery, they say, well, if a burst of energy happens, and then it happens, and then it happens, what exists between the happenings? And the question gets posed, maybe it's purpose, because the particle keeps happening with a continuous purpose. And so what things are made of is purpose. How's that for a shift? Shouldn't surprise us. We've had that all along. And God said, and it was. In the beginning was the Word. The Word was with God. The Word was God. All things were made through Him. And the Word became flesh. The major shift for me is that probably it didn't all happen at the beginning. If that purpose is continuing to shape that burst of energy, maybe God is continuing to say the word that becomes reality. And so God says your name each day, each moment, and you become who you are. And so creation is probably ongoing. And Jesus says something like that when he says, man shall not live by bread alone, but what? By every word that proceeds out of the mouth of God. That you live by every word that proceeds out of the mouth of God. Interesting flow. While I'm talking, I'd like to share with you a sheet. If you picked one up yesterday, maybe you can remember it, or let others have one who may not have one. Let me split those and start them on both sides here. I'm needing to catch you up with what we did yesterday, because it's going to really relate to what we're going to do today. And it creates a framework that I think will help you understand why and where we're going. Jesus says something like, if your eye is sound, your whole body will become full of light, and you will become bright as a lamp. That sounds like a here and now happening. That is, sounds like something that's going on. That the way in which we tune into God, if our eye is open to God, that might be a definition of faith. If we are open to being receptive and tuned into God and God's will, we can receive God's light. And it not only receive it, but it can affect the whole way our being functions. We become bright as a lamp. That can mean vitality, health, vigor, all of those things. So what occurred to me is that the basic manifestations of God, of God's word, are these three. One is light. Jesus says, I am the light. You are the light, become the light, walk in the light, receive the light, be filled with the light. And God is love. And scripture says, abide in his love. Love the Lord your God and let receive God's love. We love because God first loved us. God has loved us and we abide in, we participate in. Notice that kind of language. That it's a participatory, a receptive moving with. And then Jesus promises, I will send you my Spirit. Receive the Holy Spirit. Be filled with the Spirit. Let the Spirit guide you. Let the Spirit empower you. So this model is saying that First, let me, the old mechanical model, the Newtonian sense that this is who we are, and I am here and God is there, we tended to have this big gap. I believe in God. Well, this model says God is blessing me, is giving me life, who I am and what I am and how I am in all kinds of ways is an ongoing gift of God. And the real issue is whether I am receiving what God is giving. And the receiving language I believe Jesus used was faith. If you have faith, you can. If you have faith, you are a child of God. If you have faith, you have life. If you have faith, you will be healed, be changed. It's an ongoing participation in God's gifts. So it is both belief in, and we Lutherans really like that, because belief in means we've got to have all this theology that we believe in. And man, we're good at that. But we often miss then some of the idea that belief, our faith, is receptivity, being filled. Wow. And we need that dimension, that experience also, of participating in the presence and the reign and the work of God. Seek first the reign of God. Seek first all that God is doing and giving you, and all these other things are going to fall into place. So what I have drawn here is a new definition of who you are. And that you've tended to think of yourself as an it, and you're here and God is there. And then it sounds like kind of an option. Well, I can believe in God or not believe in God. But this model says there's no way you aren't related to God. It's a question of whether you're tuning in. A holy example of that is if I had a television box or set here, would it be a television set in and of itself? No. It's only a television set with a sending station. You are who you are only by the grace and manifestation of God's presence in you. You are created, you are being always created in the image of God. And so you have an ongoing relationship with God. And so who you are is a person being manifested by God's presence, rather than I'm this it. So faith then becomes critical. It's not an option. It's either we live by faith or we live by fear. And if we live by fear, we shut off all that God's trying to give us. Whereas if we live by faith, we are open up and we are fed and we are empowered. And so we don't have an option of whether we relate to God. It's how we relate to Him. And now, finally, I'm ready to get to where we're going. And what do we call that which gets in the way of our relating to God?
Sin.
Sin. And what do you think of when you think of sin?
Broken relationship.
Broken relationship?
Selfishness.
What is that?
Selfishness.
Greed.
Ten Commandments.
Mm-hmm. False idols.
Okay. We tend to think in terms of what we're doing, and tend to think in terms of acts. So what we might feel guilty for is I did this or I did that, and that wasn't too good. What I want to deal with is that sin is not acts. Sin is a whole way of living life. Sin insidiously saps the energy from you. It permeates everything you do. It is so subtle that you have difficulty even being aware of it. And that's what I want to get at today. Now, our answer is we are justified by grace through faith. Therefore, we Lutherans anyway. If that's the answer, what is the problem?
Lack of faith.
Okay.
Lack of courage.
Okay. If we are justified by grace, what is the opposite?
Sanctification.
So you are in bondage and cannot free yourselves.
Okay. Now, just if the opposite to being justified by God's grace is doing our own thing. I can justify who I am. I can make myself significant. I can make myself important. I can create a somebody. Now that's what I want to look at. Beyond basic survival, food and shelter, the question of what are the basic needs of a human being was raised. What really motivates us? Well, Freud said pleasure. We really want to get away from pain and we're drawn towards pleasure, and that's what drives us in life. Alfred Adler said, no, it's not pleasure, it's power. What we really want is to have power, control over everything in life. And we can identify with those. And then Viktor Frankl said, no, he spent quite a bit of time in the prisoner of war camps, and he said those who were trying to strive for pleasure didn't last long. Those who had to control the situation didn't last long. Those who really survived had a sense of meaning and purpose in their life. They knew who they were, far beyond the boundaries of that prisoner of war camp. So he says the deepest need of a human being is the need to feel significant, the need to have meaning in life. And that sure fits with what we're going to look at. For me, understanding sin has been greatly enriched by looking at the temptations of Jesus. By the way, if you're attending Scott's Bible studies, we are doing a lot of paralleling. He's going to do the temptations of Jesus tomorrow morning, so you might want to go and hear a different perspective and think with him also. Notice where the temptations start. We tend to think of three temptations, but I think there's a prior one, and that's the first words that come from the devil. Does anyone remember the first word? Two letters. If. If. What does if do?
Question.
Doubt. If you are the Son of God, if you are significant, if you have any importance in life, notice the question. Doubt who you are. Be afraid you're a nobody. That's the basis. That's the deep underlying anxiety. A seminary professor of mine said, well, we have these words for anxiety in English, worry and anxiety and so forth. He said, but we just don't have a word like there is in the German language. He says, they have the word angst. Now, angst is that deep underlying anxiety that something's not right. So that's what is created by the if. And notice then the three temptations. We've got the groundwork. Be afraid, you're nobody. And the first temptation, hey, Jesus, turn these stones into bread. Then you'll know you're somebody. Now, my understanding of that is, first, would it be a sin for Jesus to turn stones into bread? He fed the 5,000. No, unless. How does it become a sin?
He doubted himself.
The motive. Yeah. If Jesus turned stones into bread to prove he was the Son of God, the devil would have had him. Because then he could do that once, and next time he'd have to turn two stones into bread. Because it's never enough. The anxiety, the fear always rises up and says, is that enough? Am I really somebody now? And it's not enough. So the first temptation is prove who you are by what you can do, by your abilities, your talents. And so what happens, I'm going to finish the three first, and then come back. The second temptation, throw yourself off the pinnacle and get God to send his angels to take care of you. To trust God, is that a sin? See how smart the devil is? No, that's not a sin. I mean, after all, God promises to take care of us. And especially Jesus, you know, no big deal. Go jump off the pinnacle. And Jesus says, you shall not tempt the Lord your God. And how do we translate that? For me, we are tempted to believe that we can be somebody by those reactions we can evoke from others. If we can get others to approve of us, to take care of us, to love us, then we can say, wow, I must be somebody. Because they really think I'm great, good, whatever. Or they really want to take care of me. They must really think I'm worth it. So we begin to manipulate others to evoke from them our own significance. The third one is, bow down to me, Jesus, and I'll give you dominion over all the lands of the earth. He's already Lord of Lords, so big deal. So the temptation is that we will know that we're somebody by our possessions and our positions. And so I am somebody because of the car I drive or the house I live in or because I'm president of this or dish team captain or whatever it is. My role, I am somebody because I'm a mother or a father or whatever. And we begin to define ourselves and think that those things justify us. Now, let's see how sin develops. What happens is that if I'm proving who I am by what I do, I always have to keep doing more. I always have to be better. And I begin to hold myself in such a way that makes myself be able to do whatever I need to do. So I hold myself in different ways. And notice what I'm doing. I create tension inside here. I've got to be 2 inches taller. I've got to be this. I've got to be this. And so what I'm doing is creating tension that begins to affect my blood flow, my immune system, my breathing. And that creates a seedbed for illness and disease. So that whole system is how sin is related to how we create our illnesses. Now it's often a long process. It's not one act of, it isn't one sin that we're being punished for. But it's the whole way we strive in life to make ourselves somebody. And what happens is we start this very early in life and we build a whole lifestyle around our abilities for which we can be recognized. I am somebody because I can do this and this and this and this. Now, when I create my worth in somebody by manipulating others, the same thing happens. I find someone and they seem to like me and I feel really good, and wow, I like them back. And then some days they don't like me so much, and I begin to think, ooh, I've got to make them like me more. So I manipulate all the more. And then they don't like being manipulated that way, and it doesn't quite work, and I've got to try all the harder. And so the strain on relationships begins to really begin to destroy the relationships. And that's what happens often in our close relationships. That's why we say we often hurt the ones we love, because we really manipulate in order to get the affirmations we need. For instance, then, well, I'll give you an example of that in a minute. Let's, the possessions and the positions, the same thing happens. If I'm using possessions to prove my worth, I need ever more and more possessions. And so we begin to overuse the resources of the earth. I need two cars now, not one, maybe three, and another television set, and another this, and another that. And Jesus says about the rich man that builds bigger and bigger barns, you know, doesn't he know that his soul will be required of him? What does it profit a man if you get the whole world and lose his soul? So that's where the destructiveness of sin comes. It comes out of that need to justify, to prove our worth, and we destroy ourselves, we deaden our capacities. We can't see because we will let ourselves only see those things that justify us. We don't hear because we only want to hear what fits. We only let people be in our lives that support our somebody. We try to get rid of those that don't. And our positions, we always need bigger and better positions and so forth. And then if we take that out, and all of us doing this, we reach the point where there are wars, whole cultures trying to prove our worth, and we got to have more and more to do that. So those acts grow out of this whole seedbed. And the problem is that we become aware, we build a whole lifestyle to do this. Now notice Jesus talking about sin. In the Sermon on the Mount, one of the problems is that it's very easy to take the Ten Commandments or laws and use them to justify ourselves. And this was a real concern for Jesus. Notice he was the hardest on religious people when he talked about sin. So he said, it's written you shall not murder, but I say don't be angry. It's written you shall not commit adultery, be not lustful. In other words, let's get beyond the act to the motivation and the inner feelings. Do not divorce except in the case of unchastity. Do not swear at all, but say yes or no. Not an eye for an eye, but turn the other cheek. Notice how each of those is pushing people to say, hey, wait a minute, you think you're justified by the law, but have you really lived up to the essence of the law or what the law is really about? And those were dealing with acts. And then notice how he goes on. Beware of practicing your piety before others. Give alms in secret. What he's saying is that the person giving alms, that is the essence of the person's sin, because it's the wrong motivation. The person's giving alms to be seen. That's how subtle sin is. And pray not as the hypocrites. Could prayer be our sin? For they love to stand and be seen. Pray in secret. Don't heap up empty phrases. And then he goes on and gives them the Lord's Prayer, because the empty phrases is, again, kind of making what I do significant more than the prayer. When you fast, do not look dismal. Instead, put oil on your head and wash your face. In other words, don't walk around looking like, "Boy, I'm really suffering. Don't you see how righteous I am?" Do not store up treasures on earth for yourselves, but store up treasures in heaven. So Jesus, in his ministry, was getting at this subtle self-righteousness, self-justification, proving our worth as he talked about sin. Now, I'd like to bring that down to how it happens in our lives, and often it happens very subtly. Some concepts from transactional analysis have been really helpful for me. One of the ideas is that when we start out, that often non-verbally, our parents' fear about their own worth gets communicated non-verbally. And so children often end up feeling, and I've worked with people with these messages, the first message would don't be, life would be better if you weren't here. And so a person getting a don't be kind of message, that they were in the way, they shouldn't exist, and so forth, is to try to not be present. And one of the ways they do it by not breathing much. They cut down their breathing so they don't get noticed. They don't make any noise. They try not to be present. They shut down. And they deaden themselves. Another one then is don't be you. That there's something about you that is wrong or is not okay. For instance, and what we do then is try to hide or repress or shut down that part of us. So for instance, if we're afraid that if we are angry, we are nobody. We try to swallow that anger and we try to hide it and repress it. We spend a great deal of energy repressing, holding that, because we're afraid if we have any anger, that somehow that'll make us not okay. Sexuality. Hide your sexual feelings. Have the feeling if we were sexual beings that there would be something basically wrong with us. Or don't show tears. Or don't be too happy. What are you so happy about? Don't be so strong. You know, the power of people. Don't be weak. There's something wrong with you. Don't be attractive. Don't be ugly. So we're afraid, oh, I've got to hide my attractiveness. Or I've got to hide my ugliness. And so we begin in our bodies to have whole ways of shutting down, holding in parts of us, because we're afraid if it comes out and it gets known or shown, somehow it will be nobody. A couple others that aren't as common is don't be close. Someone who doesn't want to get close just for fear of closeness. So the child yearns for some contact, but everything is so busy or so officious and so forth that there's no sense of closeness. Another one is don't belong. It's interesting how many people come in for counseling and say, you know, as a child I was sure I was adopted. I just don't belong to this family. That they got the feeling that they were not really a member of the family. And so that results in kind of a deep, holding, deniable self. And Fritz Perls, in his good therapy ideas, talks about that tremendous energy to deny and hold those aspects of ourselves. And then he said we put a layer of deadness over that. And then we build what we think we have to be in order to become somebody. And we get these messages like, be perfect. I have to do everything perfectly. I have to always be right. I have to always be smart. I have to always be good. And we have perfect kinds of things. So we try to make ourselves as perfect as possible and think that we have to do that in order to be somebody. Another one is try hard. Well, gee, I must not be trying hard enough to be what I'm supposed to be, so I will try harder. And so whenever we do things, we always have the feeling like we're trying, we need to try harder. And often you'll hear a person say, boy, man, I just did everything I could, and I tried so hard, and I just, you know. And that's how they talk about what they do, is because they have the feeling that they always have to be trying harder to be and do what they think they have to be. Another one is hurry up. One of the ways I learned that one is my dad was always hurrying, and we were always talking about how to get things done as efficiently and quickly as possible. And then the image I have, often we learn by watching, is my dad running, mowing the lawn. And so I got the idea that to be somebody, I had to always hurry up. And one day, it was a Sunday afternoon, I was driving along, and I really didn't have any place that I was going. I was out for a ride. And I found myself, vroom, vroom, and boy, I was just weaving through traffic and really getting there. And all of a sudden, I said, wait a minute, I don't have any place to go. And it really made me aware. See, usually I would start late enough for where I was going, so I'd have to hurry up to get there. And that's how I knew you had to hurry in life always to get everything in. But all of a sudden, I didn't have any place to go, and it just hit me. This is a program in me. This has nothing to do with reality. And what happens is we create life for ourselves to prove whatever we believe it has to be. So that's how I would make it proved over and over. I would start late enough, and if I didn't hurry, I didn't get there in time. So I could say, see, you've got to hurry all your life. Another one is please others. Ah, if I just please others enough, then I will be somebody. And mother or dad says, if you just please me, then I'll really love you. And so these people are always tuned in. What do you want? What do you like? You want to go to a movie? What do you think? Is there a movie you'd like to go to? Well, what do you think? And so they never really want to say where they're at. They always have to figure out where someone else is at and how they can please them, because that's how they become somebody. Another one that hit very close to home for me is be responsible. I grew up in a Lutheran family, and every time we'd come home from church, we'd talk about how things went, and if anything didn't go as well as we thought it should, and how we were responsible to figure out what to do about it. So I got the idea as a kid, if I was just responsible enough for everything, then I would be somebody. And I can remember my dad built a little stool for the sink, and my mother would taught us how to do dishes early. And I was standing on the stool during the dishes, and my mother was in the living room talking to a neighbor and saying, isn't that wonderful how he does the dishes? And I thought, wow, I'm really somebody now. A whole script of life. I am always helping people as I grew up. And it looks so good. I go on and I become a pastor. I become a social worker. How responsible can you get? What's the problem? If you looked at what I would do, it looked good. But I could not love you. If I met you, I would have to find out a problem you had and solve it so I could look like the responsible one. That's not love. That's manipulation. That's how insidious this is. That's sin. Manipulating people to make ourselves people of worth. And that gets in the way of our love. And it becomes a trap of what I would experience is I was always working too hard. I got pain in my shoulders. And I would get tense because I had to make everything come out okay. And, you know, my hands would shake, and I just had to go to church every night so I could be responsible for everything. And it drained my energy, and it looked good. Now, to come to the realization that the very thing that is my strength is my idolatry. That's what sin is about. The way we use even our best of acts to look good. And we are so trapped in it that we lead to our own destruction by the breakdowns in our body systems as we overload them and strain them. We break our relationships because we're manipulating. And we overuse the earth and destroy it, and we have to overcome people who take too much of the earth from us. And we can justify wars, and we can justify all kinds of things. We can justify tearing down and destroying people. Because if we get threatened enough, we're capable of anything. That's how critical being somebody is. Being justified by our own acts. That is what sin is. Now, how do we get set free? What does it mean to be forgiven? What does it mean to let go? What does it mean to be free from this insidious way of life that saps our energy, deadens our senses, and destroys all of life? Well, it's not just by getting some ideas about how to live a better life. Well, if I just cared for the poor more, I'd be great. Boy, if that's, see, man, I can do that. I'll just care for the poor more. And so we take any suggestions about how to improve ourselves, and we very nicely incorporate it into our spirit. Jesus says, he who finds his life will lose it. Now that's what we're talking about, is that finally I can destroy myself with all my straining and strive. I can destroy my relationship. I can destroy all that. So if my self is successful, I ultimately will destroy it myself. That's why Jesus says it's harder for the rich man to enter the kingdom of God than for the camel to pass through the eye of the needle. Why? Because his self, if it's built around his riches, is successful. And he doesn't want to let go. Jesus says to the rich young man, who says, hey, I followed all the rules, I've done everything, what do I need to do to inherit eternal life? Go sell all that you have and give it to the poor. Is that the answer? No. That's an awareness exercise. Because that was said to help that young man realize how much he hung on to his riches. We are deeply scared and we hang on to our ways of proving our worth. I remember as a kid being very about, we would go over to my uncle's place, and they had a basement, and it was really dark in the basement. And I remember I was really scared to go down in the basement. How do you get someone to go into what they're scared to death of? Well, they could say, there's nothing down there, just go down there. No way. No way. Finally, my uncle says, here, take my hand. I'll go with you. This is what Jesus says. He says, I'm going to go die. Come with me. Deny yourself. Take up your cross. Be ready to lose everything. And follow me. And so he goes in through the death of the cross, showing us that he could lose all of his abilities to do things as they drained the blood finally from his body. And that he could totally lose all approval of others as they spit on him and denied him and deserted him and mocked him and how they crucify him. You know, anything that we think of as approval from others, he lost it all. And finally they cast lots for his linen garment, his robe, and they mocked his position, ha ha, the King of the Jews. And so for me, what the crucifixion is about is Jesus, and why Jesus needed to do it is because we're too scared to do it by ourselves. And he says, come on, I want you to discover that you can lose everything, even your life. So come die with me and discover that in losing everything, I am who I am and you are who you are by the grace of God. All your striving, straining, and hanging on is forgiven. Give it up. Let it go. Just discover that you don't need to hang on to anything. There's nothing you need to prove. Who you are is a gift of the grace of God. That you are somebody. You are a child of God. You are significant. You are important eternally. You have a significant role in life, not because of what you do or how you are, but because you are a child of God by God's grace. Now the shift that takes place then is to be able to say, I do what I do not in order to become somebody, but because I am somebody by the grace of God. To apply that to me, I discovered I did not need to be responsible for everybody and everything in order to become somebody. But notice this, because I am a child of God, I can be responsive to people. The opposite is not being irresponsible. The opposite is my motivation, so that I can be somebody because of I am somebody by the grace of God. And the shift is then I can relax and I can be responsive. My life in counseling, I relaxed and I began to really enjoy. And I could come home after a day of counseling and I was still relaxed and refreshed. I didn't have to be totally exhausted because I didn't need to make it all happen. There's a whole different feel to it. And you may want to say, what am I hanging on to? What do I think really makes me important? And what would it mean to let go of striving to do that and really accepting I am who I am by the grace of God? Okay, questions or comments?
Scientific method has encouraged us to look at the particulars, and that has a scientific way of looking at life, and this is me, as justice, and it's been followed on, I think, somewhat theologically, in theological circles. You seem to be going in a different direction than that. You look behind you and see if anybody's following.
Well, I think there's a lot of signals happening in science. Many of those views are being challenged by quantum physics. And so in some ways I see what I'm doing as following. I also believe that what Jesus did was really all done to free us for new life. And I've struggled with paradigms that seem to help me know that experientially. And sometimes the paradigms that we've used, it's been hard for me to experience really being set free by the concept of atonement, that Jesus paid the price for me. That's a Jewish framework that was very meaningful. They lived with sacrifice and paid the price. And that is very meaningful for them. I'm questioning whether that is really meaningful for us today, that we really have a sense that somehow God needs to be paid something for our sin. So this makes more sense to me and feels more like it has to do with where I'm at. Okay, let's do some experiential stuff. What I'd like to have you do is kind of sit straight in your chair, put your things down. Close your eyes if you'd like, if you can help shut out the external stimulus. Bring your awareness to your breathing. Awareness is being present to whatever is and is happening in you. There's no need to change anything. So just notice what's happening. Now move your awareness down to your feet. Be aware of the way your feet touch the floor. Be aware of the balls of your feet. Your toes. Your arches. Your ankles. And then move up to your calves. Your knees. Your thighs. Be aware of both feet and legs. And as you are, you may notice some tingling or some warming. Sometimes you notice some letting go. Move your awareness to your lower back. Move up your back, along your spine. Between your shoulder blades, your shoulders, the base of your skull, your neck. Now move to your right arm, your right shoulder, and start out your biceps, your elbow, your forearm, your wrist, the palm of your hand, your fingers, you may notice some tingling or some warming of your hand. Notice the difference between your right arm and left arm. to your left shoulder. Move on to your biceps. Your elbow. Your forearm. Your wrist. Palm of your hand. Your fingers. Be present to your whole left arm. Now compare your right arm and your left arm. To your breathing. Bring your awareness to your abdomen. Your solar plexus. Let yourself be aware of your heartbeat. Move your awareness to your lungs. Your throat. Your nostrils. Your jaw. Your ears, your temples, behind your eyes, and the hairs on your head. The warmth of your body, the vitality and energy of your body, a deep sense of who you are by the grace of God. That there is nothing that you need to do. To prove that worth. To make it happen. Sense of peace that Jesus comes to give. Being at peace with who you are. Of life. And as you exhale, let your eyes open and let yourself stay in the state of peace and yet become present to the world.